Hello, and welcome back to Elder Sign, a weird fiction podcast by Clay Temple Media. I'm Glenn McDorman.
And I'm Brandon Buddha. In today's episode, we'll be looking at The Vampire Salamander by Leon Bloy. This story was published in 1893.
This story, as really everything that we do here, was nominated by a Patreon supporter, and I want to say a huge thanks to really all of our Patreon supporters who participate in this process by nominating stories, by voting on them, and just by keeping the lights on here. We're so grateful for all of you who allow us to continue doing this thing. We should say a few things about this story before we get into it. First is that it's not originally written in English. It's originally written in French. And so we were reading this in a translation by Eric Butler. It is also not solely a standalone story. It is part of a series of stories that are linked or connected in some way called Sweating Blood. That volume was published in its entirety in 1893. And the deal with these stories, with all of these stories, is that they are about the Franco-Prussian War.
Yeah, that's right. And boy, that was a war of horrors, and that's ostensibly why we're covering this, as, you know, on Patreon, kind of adjacent to Elder Sign. And this story is very dark. I want to warn our listeners, it's almost not a story, but we will, it does have some elements related to horror that we'll be talking about. But I think this story made us both feel probably pretty uncomfortable, as it invites us to kind of stare into the face of victims of war in really difficult ways, and to really grapple with the questions of the value of war. That's really what Bloy's project is. And so we're going to do our best here today to kind of just handle the story and talk about it. But I guess that's all I have to say by way of introduction here, Glenn. Why don't we get to the text itself?
Yeah, I think I can detect in your voice, Brandon, actually a little reticence to talk about this. And I share that with you. This is a disturbing story. This also isn't the first story that we've done from this collection. We did a story called The Mud. We did that last November on Patreon. It was our Remembrance Day episode. So we have a sense of what we're in for here. The regular listeners to Elder Sign may not. And it is going to be disturbing. But before we get to that, let's really start by situating ourselves in place and time. As I said, the entirety of Sweating Blood, and then also this little piece, I guess we could call this a vignette maybe, this is all set during the Franco-Prussian War of 1870 and 1871. And from a soldier's perspective, this war is really one of several precursors to the just absolute and utter tragedy of the First World War, which is to say that the conditions were terrible, the technology was terrifying, and the Prussian army brought war to the French civilians really as much as they were bringing the war to the French army. And also the purpose of the war was just very, very stupid. And these are all things that we see repeated in the First World War. And this is really the tack that Bloy takes here, is to look at these elements of the war, at least in these two pieces that we have read so far. And interestingly, this one opens not with the present war, but actually with some discussion of the burial practices of 5th century Visigoths. And what he's thinking about here is the famous burial of Alaric, the Visigothic leader who sacked Rome in 410. And this burial, it involved diverting a river so that Alaric could be buried beneath the river itself. So they diverted it for a little while, dug a grave, buried him, and then took the dams away so that then the river would resume its normal course. And this is the period that I work on in my professional life, or have worked on in my professional life. And so I can say that this is something that scholars have used a lot of ink on, but nonetheless, it is also something that we don't really understand. But at any rate, for Bloy, and that's really what we're doing here. So for Bloy, this is really just a way of engaging his readers to think about the practices of the Germans in regards to their war dead. And the transition here involves thinking of the Germans as the descendants of the Visigoths, which, with my professional hat on, I will just say that's really stupid, but we don't need to dwell on that. Or, you know, if you want to sign up for a class that I'll teach soon. At any rate, the point is that the German dead don't seem to stay dead. And sometimes this is just a matter of not being able to find their bodies where the French soldiers know that there should be bodies. But in some cases, they did find the dead Germans buried in the ground, but usually it was the dogs who found them first. And this opening, and this is really just a page here, but this opening is extraordinarily vivid. It's extraordinarily haunted and I think extraordinarily gothic. And it seems very much like Bloy is getting ready to tell a type of horror story. And he is, of course, but also it's just not going to have any supernatural elements to it.
Right. I mean, even the title of this story, The Vampire Salamander, suggests gothic horror, or at least something relatively ghoulish. And the ghoulishness will come, but there will be no easy pleasures that we can really derive from the horrors of this tale, if any kind of pleasure can be found within it at all, you know, from the perspective of a reader or a spectator, or an audience member, however you want to aesthetically categorize, you know, the we who are reading it. But, you know, regarding this business with the Visigoths and Germans, I suspect that there is some prejudice here on the part of Bloy, the kind of prejudice really that soldiers are often invited to participate in when considering the nature of their enemy or the opposition that they are fighting in war. There's all kinds of myths, whispers, and rumors that inform the soldier about their enemy. I recall many unsavory things of which I learned about Afghani and Iraqi citizens and soldiers. I was often shocked to discover that those things turned out to be manifestly untrue when I, you know, got to college and saw some documentaries about the war that I participated in. But, you know, for Bloy, these sorts of whispers are easily turned into an insult, kind of hurtled towards the Prussian soldiers who, you know, he says hide their dead between apple trees. And then the living soldiers mark the trees with the hopes of finding them again. But wild dogs eat the bodies before the Germans can return. You alluded to this, Glenn, in your recap. So in essence, Bloy, or the voice Bloy is using, is kind of calling the Prussians dumb and telling us that their efforts to honor their dead functionally result in their dead's desecration. But in any event, you know, all of this stuff about hiding burial sites of war heroes and so on, it does have a structural function in the story as well. I guess what I'm saying is, as unsavory and difficult as this story is, on the purely craft level, Bloy is doing something kind of raw and honest, even as he engages with kind of the artifices of storytelling.
Right. This really could be the opening to any kind of supernatural horror story. It does have all of the hallmarks of this, really, you know, especially in this gothic mode, as you're talking about here. It's absolutely brilliant. But you are correct that it is also engaging with all of these standard ways of dehumanizing your enemy in wartime by saying that there are a number of things that they don't do or don't care about that any fully functional civilized human would. The one we've gotten here so far really is the treatment of the dead, right? Are you caring about the dead bodies of your soldiers or not? Or also perhaps you're desecrating the bodies of the enemy soldiers, right? Those are things that you can't do, right? And so not following the conventions of treatment and reverence of war dead is one of the things that you hold up in your propaganda to say these people we're fighting are subhuman in some way. Of course, the other things that you do are not care about the wounded and also not care about women and children. And we're going to see Bloy tick those boxes in this story as well. In fact, let's go get some of that. Let's get to the actual character here of the vampire salamander. Now, the salamander is a person. He's a French soldier, and he has been very badly burned by the Prussian soldiers. In fact, burned so badly that he no longer has any eyelids, which is how he got this nickname, the salamander. He also no longer has a nose, lips, or ears. He's also missing a lot of fingers. And how this happened is that he had been wounded in the Battle of Gravelotte, which was the largest battle of the war, and he had been in a makeshift infirmary when the French army retreated, and here's where we're going to get one of these dehumanizing tropes here. Rather than deal with the French wounded, the Prussian army set fire to the infirmary. Now, the salamander survived and escaped, but of course, this is a traumatizing experience, so even though his body has survived, he's not in good shape here. But it isn't even the only traumatizing experience that the salamander has had in the war. What brought him to the army to begin with is that when his community was occupied by the Prussian army, the soldiers raped his wife and daughter, well, they made him watch, and then, in front of him, still making him watch, they also killed the wife and daughter once they were done raping them. And so the salamander is here. The salamander is in the army here because he's after vengeance. And that desire for vengeance seems to be how he managed to survive this horrible fire as well.
This is a mercifully short story, and I really do mean mercifully here. Just reading about these atrocities is so difficult, and anybody who studied war comes across stories like these, and it's just heartbreaking the depths to which, you know, humanity can sink in service of some kind of larger ideal. But to me, I think the most difficult thing, you know, that I encountered in reading this story, you know, not just reading the things that informed Salamander's trauma, but thinking about him as a person. Like, you know, when you read about these atrocities, the things that he survived, the death of his wife and daughter in one of the most brutal ways imaginable, his survival in the fire that was meant to be a hospital, you know that there's really no future beyond the war for him. He is so defined by his traumas, both physically and emotionally, that you know there can be no life for him post-war. He's a creature, like a beast, that has been forged by the war only for use in the war. And that's it now. Everything he wanted in his life, everything he hoped for is already dead. And this in itself is a real tragedy. But on the literary side, on the criticism side, which we are here to do, Bloy is giving us a really close and great exploration of monstrosity. And this will be our primary topic in the discussion. But yes, for those of you who are faint of heart, I'd really consider avoiding stories about war atrocities in general, and maybe perhaps Leon Bloy in particular. For those of you who like to be reminded of what sort of rot lurks beneath the mask of civility and civilization, you know, you don't have to look too far back in our own history or even deeply into our present to find the things you're looking for. This sort of rot is really everywhere, and it's always hard to be reminded of it, even though this story was written, you know, 150 years ago or so.
I am not very often viscerally affected by the types of stories that we read here. And I mean viscerally in a literal sense here, where this story made me feel sick to my stomach. And I'll be honest here, I've been dreading doing this episode because it meant I was going to have to revisit the story. I was going to have to read it again last night, talk about it, put myself back in this. It's incredibly effective at doing this, but it is a feeling that I don't like having. And it's also the case that I don't very often insert myself into the stories that we cover. I mean, when we're doing occult detective stories, I mean, those are frequently just romps. They're just rides that I'm along for the joy and entertainment of it. But this is a story where I couldn't help but envision myself in the role of the salamander here, thinking about my own family and what if some kind of war came to America and this experience happened to me. And maybe this is a big part of why this made me feel the story so much in my own body. But it's a story that is incredibly uncomfortable. It made me feel very, very bad. Of course, that's the point of the story. It's the point of this whole collection, Sweating Blood. Bloy succeeds marvelously at it, but it is an experience that I can only take in small and infrequent doses.
Yeah, it's something that I, you know, just find so difficult to explore in general. I do think that stories like this, books like this, are a necessity for Western humanities, for the canon. I think more people should be reading stories like this. People who are maybe going to serve on a political level, people who are thinking about serving in the military. When you still have this deep connection and deep ties to the people around you and your community, to remind yourself of what can happen if you don't govern well, if you care about the wrong things, or if you as a soldier are being given heinous instructions to carry out or something like that. Also just knowing what people, quote unquote, civilized people are capable of, how propaganda functions. This is a necessary kind of story. It's not one I want to stew in.
Well, we do have still a little bit more stewing to do before we break for the discussion. So I'll finish us up here with the recap. Now, even though the salamander is horribly wounded in this way that we have already described, he is still fighting. Now, he can't use a gun anymore because he's missing fingers, but he's great at stabbing. But as I said, he is here really for revenge. Now, he is not specifically looking for the individual soldiers who murdered his family. Rather, what he's doing is just killing as many Prussian soldiers as he can. And then he is also desecrating their graves and even mutilating their dead bodies. And the narrator recounts one incident where some Prussian soldiers caught him doing this, and one of them died immediately from an aneurysm, from the shock, the horror of seeing what the salamander was doing. And this is how the salamander becomes not just the salamander, but the vampire salamander. What's more, when he does finally die, and this happens shortly after the armistice has been signed, there are some strange letters that his comrades find in his pockets. And it turns out that in addition to desecrating the graves and mutilating the bodies of Prussian soldiers, he has also been writing letters to their families describing what he has done to them. Now, these aren't addressing real people. I should be clear about that, since he can't actually know anything about them, and he wasn't going to be able to mail these to Prussia in some way. What he's doing here is envisioning, he's imagining a family member. Maybe it's a mother, maybe it's a wife or a child, and then writing a letter to that imaginary person. And this might actually be the most horrifying part of the story, and that's where the story ends. And so that is the vampire salamander.
I mean, another kind of horrifying part of the story is the tone in which there's a tacit approval for the vampire salamander's behavior, even though we've set up the story, or Bloy has set up the story, telling us these idiot Prussians leave their soldiers out to be eaten by dogs. But like, look at what we have on our side. You know, they do it by accident, but we have this intentional beast monster who works for our side, who does this. And we, you know, it's the kind of thing is like that you see in propaganda all the time. And the paradox is when we do it, it's okay. When you do it, it's an act of malevolence and evil. And it's a very difficult story. We'll be digging into all of that. But where I really want to start, I think, our discussion here is just by giving our listeners a taste of some of the descriptive prose that Bloy has written here, not just because it's very evocative, but also so that we can be oriented towards, you know, the really only topic that I have for this story, which is monstrosity. So I want to start by reading this description of the vampire salamander that is provided by Bloy. Here's what he says. "I'm not sure if it's easier to imagine or describe such horror. He'd managed to save his eyes, even if they now had no lids. They were like two dark metal nails driven into swollen holes. But his nose, lips, and ears had vanished, and three quarters of his face was black and calcinated, as if a brush dipped in lava had passed over it. They'd had to amputate three fingers on his right hand. His perpetual limp, which bizarre twitches aggravated, gave one reason to surmise that the rest of his person had also ended the cruel intimacy of the brand. I basted in the poor bugger's fat," he said. And a little further on, Bloy writes of Salamander's experience in the fire that sort of forged him, that here, in the shadows of the netherworld, his phantasmagoric countenance was forged. So really what we have here is a monster, the grotesque salamander who was once a man, who was forged in a netherworld. Now, I should mention that monster here is a word, you know, that became very popular and has really been in our lexicon, you know, since the novel Frankenstein was written by Mary Shelley. Maybe it was more before, but we can go to that reference point here, which indicates, you know, something made by man. But really, monster initially connotes something like beastliness, like some combination of man and beast. And we have that here with salamander, but then also when we think of other monsters like vampires or so on, who take on aspects of animals in order to feed on people and so on. And this vampire salamander, this character does become a ghoulish figure and takes on that moniker of vampire because he maybe eats and also desecrates the dead. And so maybe this is a little tone deaf, but I feel like maybe the best way to approach this story is to think of it as a monster story. So Glenn, I guess just to orient ourselves a bit, for you, you know, what comes to mind when you think of a monster story? What kind of features does a tale like that have?
Well, I love this question, and I love monsters. We actually don't do enough monsters here on Elder Sign, I don't think. We've had a few bursts where we've done some monster stories, but for the most part, we don't actually encounter monsters all that much, and I would like to do more of them. But I like the idea of reading this as a monster story, because I think that you're right, that it has many of the hallmarks of a monster. And I think one of the hallmarks for a monster, and thinking specifically of monster here in this high modern sense, originates really with Mary Shelley and Frankenstein, as you're talking about here, Brandon. But yeah, monster stories for us, right? The monster needs to be something that is physically disturbing in some way, or even physically horrifying in some way. And we, of course, get that in Frankenstein with the body being cobbled together and so on. Vampires are monstrous because of how their body functions, right? That they require the blood. Also, they can change shape and so on, I guess, depending on, you know, what type of vampire you're dealing with. But at any rate, yeah, something about the body. And we definitely have that here. But there also needs to be a sense that the monster is some kind of outsider. And we might want to think about how that's true here, or the extent to which that's true with the vampire salamander. But then also, the monster needs to be kind of a dark mirror for us, right? It needs to reflect something back to us about ourselves, or about a part of ourselves that we don't want to think about, a part of ourselves that we don't like to talk about at parties, I guess, right? And I think we have these elements here.
Those are really, really good. I actually didn't even make a list because I couldn't think of enough monster stories to really abstract out their characteristics. And I think that that's really good. The emphasis on the body, the dark mirror that the like reflects back to us things, like the nature of vengeance, perhaps, and then the outsider status of the monster. And before we move on, I do want to dig into this outsider status of the vampire salamander, because it seems to me as though Bloy is really setting up this story in a way that says, as I kind of said at the top of the discussion, hey, these guys, our enemies, are idiots for the way they handle their dead. But we've kind of let this guy off the leash to kind of enact his vengeance as part of our mission of war, to terrorize, a kind of terror campaign against the Prussian soldiers. And so, yeah, Glenn, to what degree do you see the vampire salamander here as an outsider, and to what degree is he accepted or needed, maybe, in the war? We'll talk about monsters and war next, but I just maybe want to focus on this outsider business that I think is pretty important, maybe in the frame of the propaganda notes that we've been talking about in this story.
Right, because I think what happens in this story is that as this just regular northern French farmer is transformed into this monster, part of the monstrosity is, of course, what happens to his body. But the big part of it is really what happens to his behavior, where what has happened is that he begins to behave and act in a way that is very similar to what the Prussians have done themselves. And of course, the setup of the story is, hey, the Prussians are monsters because they do these sorts of things, right? They have these characteristics. They burn hospitals. They don't care about their dead. They rape women and children and then also kill them. And they do that in front of their family members. Those are monstrous things. Those are horrible things. But look at how their action, their monstrosity, the Prussians' monstrosity, has served to turn one of our own Frenchmen into a monster as well. And I think that we get that because Blois maybe doesn't emphasize it, but he does show us that the soldiers who find these letters when the vampire salamander dies, those are French soldiers, and they are as horrified by this. They are horrified by this, right? It's not just the Prussians who are horrified by the vampire salamander's actions. It is the French soldiers as well. And so in that sense, he has been turned into a kind of unrecognizable outsider.
I think that's a really good way of putting it, that the wider French army, French culture perhaps, would loudly, I think, condemn these behaviors if they got out and say, okay, it's just one soldier here. But Blois does something interesting by introducing the vampire salamander, in a sense, by saying there was a guy in our unit who, this is the story of a guy who we knew, who like was one of our soldiers. And you know you have to rely on people in your unit. They're literally people who are fighting next to you. They are people who are going to perhaps be responsible for saving your life, for protecting your body in some sense. And so by imbuing vampire salamander with this sense of our man, Blois is playing with this kind of insider-outsider dichotomy here in a really complicated way, but I think you've done a really good job of showing at where that breaking point is, at what point he becomes an outsider. It's those who don't know him, those who could judge him beyond the unit themselves, in which he's just a part of the unit. This story is really very crunchy and very good, but like I said, we don't really want to stew in it. So I'm just going to move us along here. The last thing I kind of want to do here is just think about monsters and war, right? There's certainly an overlap, it seems, between the creation of monsters and cultural anxieties about war. Godzilla, for instance, is rooted in anxieties about, you know, nuclear and atomic powers. Though the latest monster movies that we see in this kind of universal big big mega fauna monster movies are really about climate anxiety and having these animals being like the true rulers of the earth who are letting us sojourn here and so on. You know, in any event, that's a kind of war, maybe ideological war we're fighting in our culture right now. There's no shortage of films about American soldiers fighting, zombies or ghoulish Nazis. Kong, Skull Island is full of Vietnam references. Frankenstein might not have war in its background, but it's certainly about, you know, emerging ideologies regarding the ethical limits of scientific experimentation, you know, from which new techniques emerge that, in our society at least, now serve the war machine first before serving civilization or citizens. Maybe Frankenstein's an outlier. Wolfman is probably also another outlier. I'm not sure what war created the Wolfman. But there is racist gypsy stuff usually in the early Wolfman stories. But, Blois is doing something here regarding the relationship between monsters and war. And, you know, some questions we might consider is, you know, is monstrousness a necessary part of war? Does war always create monsters or turn people into weapons of war who are kind of used up by the war's end? And so I wonder, Glenn, you know, what lines do you think Blois is drawing in this regard? How is he kind of playing into this relationship between monstrosity and war?
100% Blois is drawing a line between the experiences of war and the creation of a monster here. But I think something that might differ from some of the other examples that you're bringing up here, Brandon, is that the people who created the monster here are very clearly the enemy. And so we can read at least this one vignette here of Blois and not leave it with the sense that all war is bad, all wars are stupid. The sense here is that the Prussians are bad. The Prussians are monsters, and they go around not just conquering us and defeating us on the battlefield, but they also go around turning good French people into monsters. And the Prussians are still bad. The Prussians are evil, right? That it's not war with a capital W that is bad. And that, I think, differs from some of the other examples that you're talking about, and certainly differs from a lot of the war literature that we have in the 20th century of the person, the soldier who can't come home again, who comes home again wrong in some way, not necessarily monstrous, but not well, not whole anymore, and struggles to live in some way. And sometimes what that struggle is just being a civilian again. And in fact, deciding that war somehow is a force that provides meaning and is the only place that this person is now comfortable and wants to go back and do more war in some way. That's a real classic trope of war literature, for example. So I guess the short answer here, Brandon, to your question is that I do think that this lines up with your thesis here about monsters and the relationship with war, but is also an outlier in some ways as well.
I think that's absolutely right. It didn't even really occur to me that Bloy is not saying, you know, big W war, capital W war is bad. He's really saying the Prussians are bad and we don't like fighting war on French soil. You know, what is it doing to our nation to fight this war on our, you know, on our land and to defend our land? And I guess the last real question I want to ask is, you know, is Bloy even raising the question in this story of what civilization's duty is to the monsters that it creates? You know, if Bloy is saying the Prussians made this monster and vampire salamander's dead after armistice, because of course there's no other option for this story. There's no world to which the vampire salamander can return to. He is fully forged, as Bloy says, in this underworld of war. Does Bloy even think that post-war, that the French civilization, whatever it is, has some sort of duty to the monsters that it forges? Or is that just not even on his mind in this story?
Yeah, I think Bloy lets himself off the hook here by having the vampire salamander die. Now, I'm with you here. I think that that's what the vampire salamander himself is going for, because there is no more life for him. He has been a dead man walking since we met him in this story, that he's on a kind of suicide mission because there just is no life for him at this point. But that does also let Bloy off the hook here of having to find a way to put him in a civilian society and find a place for him and to see what that would be like, right? What could a life be like for this person? So he's let off the hook there. He doesn't grapple with that. That's just not a question I think that he's engaging with here. Of course, there are a lot of stories in this collection. You and I have only looked at two of them. So it may be the case that some of the others do deal with that. But I also would not be surprised to discover that they really don't, because I think that this question that you're asking, and maybe even a little bit of your thesis about the relationship between monsters and war, are all really informed by the experience of the First World War, which is still, you know, from the point of this book, 20 years in the future.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I was definitely thinking about how, you know, it's hard to read this story without that historical or cultural context of, you know, us being 110 years removed from the First World War that created so much of the literature that we love, or that, you know, so much literature that we love has flowed from the experiences of soldiers in the First World War, and so many of the literary tropes and kind of the literary milieu that we are a part of in terms of the genre scene is kind of really rooted in wartime experience and the way people are changed by war. I wonder if Bloy's kind of one of the first people out there doing this sort of, you know, war is hell routine, and maybe inventing some of these things that we see a lot more in the 20th century. But yeah, that's a great point. Definitely reading backwards here. I don't really have too much to say about this story. I think we've done what I wanted to do. So I'm gonna get us out of this episode. And so that's gonna do it. Once again, I'm Brandon Buda.
And I'm Glenn McDormand. And yes, a mercifully short episode today. As we said, I think this is a story that we really, I don't want to say liked or enjoyed, because those are definitely not the right words here, but it's a story that interested us and moved us, but it is not one that we want to stew in for a while here. But hopefully you all have found some value to listening to us jabber about it for a little while. And if you want to hear more of us jabbering about things, you can find us and all our other creative projects at claytemplemedia.com. Next time, we will be back with The Horror at Red Hook by H.P. Lovecraft. And until then, we greet you and say farewell.